This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
He was quick to read the changing times. He was quick to see that the wind was so strong he could not stop it.
That's political commentator Herman Manyora on the legacy of former Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi, who has died at age 95. Details coming up. Also, we have some Kenyans recalling Moi as a force for stability, and others remember him as a tyrant. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, former Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi has died at the age of 95. Moi led Kenya for 24 years, the nation's longest-serving president, crushing dissent and arresting opponents. But he's also credited with a peaceful leadership transition after his party was voted out of power in 2002. Mahmoud Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Oduor Ongwen was a student leader at the University of Nairobi in the 1980s and often clashed with the government of the late President Daniel Arap Moi.
Again, in 1986, I was arrested. Again, on a charge of sedition, I was jailed for 4 years, which I had to serve at Kamiti Maximum Prison. So those are the kind of prices I and many of our colleagues, which were progressive student leaders, had to pay. For standing out to say that Kenyans deserve better.
When Ongwen and his fellow student protested against Moi government, agents removed educational materials from the school.
The university was never the same because the libraries had been raided, the bookshops had been raided. Any material that they considered unpalatable, using what they call state security, was removed from the libraries.
As Vice President Moi came to power in 1978 after the death of Kenya's first president since independence from Britain, Jomo Kenyatta, Kenya became a de facto one-party state under the Kenya African National Union Party. Moi ruled from 1978 to 2002, Kenya's longest-serving president. Lydia Wamboi lived the Kenya's capital at the time. Wamboi says, "What I remember about him is that there were a lot of thuggeries, there were no roads and no development. There were a lot of street children and the city was very dirty. In other words, infrastructure was very bad. But on the positive, life was not that bad," she says. Moi's foes saw him as a dictator who enriched allies and cracked down on opponents. But Moi supporters like Jane Comen saw him as a strong leader who connected more directly with the people. She says Moi used to give school-going children milk, and he also helped build a lot of schools across the country. In 1990, President Moi gave in to internal and international pressure to allow multi-party elections, which he won in 1992 and 1997. Moi was constitutionally barred from running again in 2002, and his party's candidate Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of the first president, lost to Mwai Kibaki. Though Kenyatta would later be elected in 2013 and 2017, Moi quietly retired from politics. Kenya's political commentator Harman Manyora says Moi heeded to the pressure and allowed change to happen.
He was quick to read the changing times. He was quick to see that the wind was so strong he could not stop it. So he quickly allowed in change, and as the saying says, don't stop change. Bring it on and then manage it. I think he did that very, very, very effectively.
Overall, former President Moi leaves behind a mixed legacy as Kenya is still struggling to free itself from the corruption and abuses rooted in his era. But Moi can also be credited with bringing multi-party democracy to Kenya and creating the modern presidency. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Some Kenyans recall Moi as a force for stability and others remember him as a tyrant. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's second and longest-serving president, Daniel Toroitich Arap Moi, died Tuesday morning. Kenya's presidency and his family confirmed. No cause of death was given, but reports say Moi had experienced breathing problems in recent months. Gideon Moi, the former president's son, spoke at a news conference at the Nairobi hospital where Moi passed away while undergoing treatment.
I'd like to take this opportunity to tell my fellow Kenyans that Mzee passed on this morning at 5:20. He passed away peacefully. I was by his side. And as a family, we've accepted. And mine is just to give my heartfelt gratitude to all Kenyans and non-Kenyans for the prayers and thoughts that have been given to Mzee and to our family.
Moi took over Kenya's presidency following the death of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta, in 1978. Moi would then rule the country until 2002 when he retired. Moi was considered as a kind man by his supporters. 37-year-old Ken Mwema, for instance, remains nostalgic about the free milk program the president rolled out in the 90s across all public schools.
Every student was looking forward to going to school to get the free milk. Other than the milk, of course, there was a good education. Those are the very fond good memories I have of him. Yes, the country was more stable. There was more unity. Kenyans were more patriotic to Kenya. There was tribalism, but it was not as it is today. It's out there everywhere right now.
For critics, Moi was a dictator who ruled with an iron fist. Moi faced local and international criticism over human rights abuses, nepotism, and corruption. Opponents sometimes were arrested and taken to torture chambers. Survivors would later describe the chambers as being dark, filled with cold water, and with nowhere to sit. Human rights activist Ruth Mumbi blames Moi for what he calls the problems we have today.
For me, I remember Moi as a dictator, a tyrant, who didn't want to be criticized. He was one person who always felt tribal animosity, which up to date still it has been a challenge to reconcile different communities, which was his one of his undoing.
Political analyst Herman Manyora says it was Moi's leadership that kept Kenya stable at a time when other African countries were falling apart.
He was present at a time when in Africa there was a lot of turmoil, and therefore sometimes when you are leading people in times such as those, you could be seen to be a man of excesses. All around us, apart from Tanzania, all these other countries, you know, they were in a mess. They were all run down by military coups and instabilities and so on and so forth. He was able to keep the country together those bad days, difficult days, for 24 years.
In a proclamation Tuesday, President Uhuru Kenyatta described Moi as a great African statesman, an African icon, and an ardent Pan-African, and a devoted Christian. Kenyatta declared a period of national mourning that will last until Moi's funeral. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations envoy on Libya says he thinks the warring parties meeting today in Geneva are willing to work towards a lasting ceasefire. Ghassan Salame said the question is what the ceasefire conditions will be. Five senior officers representing the UN-recognized government of national accord and five from the Libyan National Army led by Khalifa Haftar are taking part in the talks. The government of national accord led by Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj holds the capital Tripoli and parts of the country's west. His government has support from Turkey, Qatar, and Italy. General Haftar's forces hold the east and have been fighting to capture the capital for months. He has the backing of the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, France, and Russia. At a summit in Berlin last month, world leaders pledged to end foreign interference in the civil war and to uphold a weapons embargo on Libya. Libya has been mired in chaos since a 2011 NATO-backed uprising that killed longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia have only agreed on 3 points of contention on construction of the controversial Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam project after 4 days of negotiations in Washington last week. The three countries agreed on a schedule that includes a plan for filling the dam in stages, a mechanism for dealing with droughts during the filling process and during the dam's operation. The U.S. drafted a document of agreement on those points that was unilaterally signed by Egypt. The three countries agreed to resume the talks on February 12th and 13th on other issues, including how to resolve disputes. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke to Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about the significance of the initial agreement.
The three countries did issue a joint statement at the end, agreeing on a couple of the important technical issues, such as a plan for filling the dam in stages, talking about contingencies in case of droughts and water scarcity, and jointly thinking through how the process is going to happen. And this is building on, you know, previous technical reviews about filling the dam in different stages. And so I think it's actually it's a positive development that they seem to have agreed to some of these technical details. In principle, it seemed that all sides had agreed on some of these technical issues. And so I think it's a positive step forward.
The three countries agreed to resume the talks on February 12 and 13 on the mechanism of monitoring and following up the implementation of the agreement, the exchange of data and information, and on the mechanism of dispute settlement. What could the U.S. mediation offer to make a final agreement achievable and verifiable?
Well, in the end, the agreement is going to have to be something that all three sides accept and abide by. And so I think the role of the U.S. is really there as a guarantor, as a means of providing assurance to all sides that their interests, their considerations will be fairly weighed, gives the parties to the agreement a recourse if they feel that, you know, something is not being fulfilled to the specifications that had been agreed to. And so I think, you know, the U.S. can play a valuable role as an outside actor, doesn't have a direct vested interest, and that can just provide some assurances. Over time, I think the goal here on all sides is to build a long-term management mechanism for the dam, that, you know, the negotiations aren't just about the current decisions on filling the dam, but it's on the long-term management. And if you can establish that basis of trust, if there's a strong technical foundation for the decisions, if all sides have been part of that, then I think it's going to lead to a lot smoother management of the dam once it's operational. I think that's what we should be looking for.
The three countries reached an initial deal in 2015, announcing the so-called Declaration of Principles, per which the dam should not cause any harm to the Nile downstream countries. What would such agreement entail in case Ethiopia imposed de facto conditions that may harm Egypt or Sudan?
Well, the statement of principles, which I think have provided a very strong basis for the negotiations all along and continue to do so, basically line out that the dam is not intended to cause significant damage to any of the parties, that there will be fair and appropriate use of the Nile resources. It talks about the importance of a trust-building process, both in terms of the negotiations for the filling of the dam, but also in the longer-term management. And I think, finally, and most importantly, that there's a principle of peaceful settlement of disputes. There's a recognition that the different sides aren't going to agree on everything, but there's an agreement that these differences can be resolved amicably and ideally among the parties themselves. But if for whatever reason that shouldn't be satisfactory, any of the parties has the right to appeal to outside mediation to try to facilitate a positive outcome. And so in that sense, I don't think the scenario of Ethiopia unilaterally making a decision that would be damaging to the other two states is likely, because Ethiopia has already agreed that this needs to be done in a cooperative manner. And if there are issues that come up that are deemed to be of concern and violation to one of the other parties, they have a means of bringing in other actors. And indeed, that's partly why the U.S. has been called in into the process at this point.
That was VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking with Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. An arrest warrant has been issued for former South African President Jacob Zuma after he failed to attend the first day of his corruption trial. It was supposed to start at the Pietermaritzburg High Court this morning, but Zuma's lawyers brought a sick note indicating that their client would not be available because he was out of the country for medical treatment. Tuso Kumalo explains from Johannesburg.
Judge Daya Pillay issued the warrant after an application by the prosecution, which expressed frustration with Zuma's failure to avail himself for the trial. Pillay expressed great frustration with the sick note, including that it had no details of what Zuma was suffering from.
This is a document titled Medical Confidential, and in brackets is marked Pharmacy Copy, without any date attached to the stamp. It uses an abbreviation, HCP, which has no explanation on the form. What this court requires is evidence, authentic, reliable proof.
There were alterations on the sick note, but the author did not sign for those. The judge also questioned the doctor's credentials after Zuma's lawyer failed to confirm his practice number. Earlier on, lead prosecutor Billy Downer told the court that Zuma had frustrated all their efforts to get more details on his illness.
So by the time he left the country, the invitation to Mr. Mancha, on behalf of Mr. Zuma, the invitation from the state to please give us some idea of what is going on, what his condition is, and why he has to go out of the country, he received that invitation, and that invitation has been ignored.
But Zuma's lawyer, Daniel Mancha, insisted that the sick note was enough proof that Zuma was indeed ill.
Yes, there's a medical certificate submitted. Yes, there's every proof that President Zuma is out of the country receiving a medical treatment. Yes, there's an offer that the matter be adjourned so that the court can satisfy itself.
The warrant was suspended pending the court's investigations on Zuma's illness claim. Experts say if the court is not satisfied and rejects Zuma's claims, he could be arrested and remanded in custody until the commencement of his trial on the 6th of May. But if he proves to the court that he was indeed ill, the warrant will be cancelled. Zuma is facing charges of corruption, fraud, racketeering, and money laundering. The charges are linked to the multi-million dollar arms deal which South Africa embarked on soon after independence. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroon is training mothers who are survivors of the conflict with Boko Haram terrorists to make a living after forced marriage and abandonment. The centers train women to raise chickens, grow their own food, and learn how to sew with the aim of opening their own businesses. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited training centers in northern Cameroon and has this report.
At a women's empowerment center in Cameroon's northern town of Kuseri, on the border with Chad and Nigeria, a group of women are learning how to sew. But this is no ordinary training center, as these women have survived being forcefully married to Boko Haram terrorists. The Islamist militants abducted 18-year-old Rumaitu Adjara, forced her to marry one of them, and then abandoned her after she had a baby. At the center, Adjara has learned to repair dresses to earn money. She says it will not be easy for her to open a seamstress shop without funding. But if she is offered a sewing machine, says Adjara, she will repair dresses at home and door to door until she will have enough clients so she can afford to rent a shop. Three other students at the center were forced to marry Boko Haram militants who were killed fighting Cameroon's military last year. Cameroon's military found the women in November near the Sambisa forest. Manager of the center, Issa Absatu, says they have trained about 40 women since November when the government ordered priority be given to Boko Haram victims. She says 20 of the women fled Boko Haram fighting in villages on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria a year ago. She says they organized literacy classes before introducing young women and girls to computers where they familiarize themselves with using the internet. Absatu says they also teach them to type and arrange documents using the computer and to become seamstresses. She says some of the women they are training are now capable of creating their own businesses. In Cameroon's northern town of Garoua, 30 more women and girls are being trained at Women's Circle, a private empowerment center. 32-year-old coordinator of the center, Frida Ngwese, says most of the women escaped from Boko Haram camps or villages where the militants are in control. She says Cameroon's government gives them grants and private donors also help the women get job training skills.
They don't have anything, and some of them, they have children to take care of. We want to make them understand that they are not alone in their fight, in the struggles, in the afflictions they are going through.
Abdoulaye Amoa is coordinator of Cameroon's program for the socioeconomic reinsertion of female victims of Boko Haram. She says there are about 200 women and girls getting training at the centers. But Amoa says the $200,000 budget is not enough to buy the equipment and training for all the women to start their own businesses. Amoa says her wish is for development partners and agencies to give them immediate assistance for resources to train the women to be independent. Contributing to the development of their families and communities, she says, would help prevent the temptation for them to return to Boko Haram camps. The Nigerian Islamist militants often use the region's high unemployment as a recruiting tool, offering jobs to those who join their fight. Last year, Cameroon began distributing 60,000 goats and sheep to young Cameroonians in villages along the border to provide them with a basic income. Boko Haram's 10-year insurgency began in northeastern Nigeria, but spilled across borders into Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, killing tens of thousands and displacing millions. Cameroon says military offensives have reduced Boko Haram's ability to launch large-scale attacks, but raids and abductions remain a threat, especially in villages along the border. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Marwa, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.